Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for December 8th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast, and in it, I'm very pleased to share with you my interview with Professor Lewis Hyde. Due to the duration of the interview, there will be no new hacker word of the week, and I'm also going to hold off on a few pieces of listener feedback until the next show or maybe the show after that. For once, I actually don't have anything to say to qualify the audio quality of the interview. Even though I spoke with Professor Hyde on a landline, we got a very good connection, and I think I was able to do a pretty darn good job in brightening up the audio and bringing it up to a nice level. So hopefully you agree and you enjoy the content as much as you enjoy the actual quality of the sound recording itself. The only other thing that I wanted to mention really quickly is since I recorded this interview with Professor Hyde, I'm now several more chapters into his very first book, The Gift, which was recently reissued in a 25th anniversary edition. And like all of his books, even on the basis of not having gotten to the halfway point, just being about five or six chapters in, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's a fantastic book, and I think that all of his books are very relevant to many of the topics that I talk about on this show, from the role of innovation and technology as forces of disruption. Very much Trickster Makes This World speaks to that aspect. The commonest error is pretty obvious as it bears very, very directly on intellectual property and that commons model in contrast to market models. And The Gift promises in the latter half of the book to get into something that I'm very fascinated by as a creator who gives his work away week after week, the role of gift exchange in that creative process and the synthesis of the internal gift and the gift with an audience. So if you haven't checked out any of his books, I do highly, highly recommend them. Professor Lewis Hyde is a poet, essayist, translator, and cultural critic. He also teaches creative writing, previously at Harvard, where he was the director of faculty for that program there, and since 1989 at Kenyon College, where he is currently the Richard L. Thomas Professor of Creative Writing. When he is not teaching at Kenyon during the fall term, he is also a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. The first book of his I read, Trickster Makes This World, is a stunning contemplation of selected myths and how they illuminate the role of cultural disruption. I have just started his first book, The Gift, recently re-released in a 25th anniversary edition by Vintage Books. I've invited him on the podcast specifically to discuss his latest book, Common as Air, published by Farrar, Straus, and Gros this August, and it brings that same brilliant insight to the cultural commons. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Glad to be here.
So to start with, what inspired you to write about the topic of the cultural commons? In the book, you explain your desire to use historical examples to shed some new light on the current circumstances of copyright in the public domain. Do you feel you succeeded?
Well, I hope I succeeded. I guess when you write a book, you find out from others whether you succeeded or not. What got me going was, I suppose, the big changes that have been taking place, both with the rise of the internet and digital copying, which have confused the old rules of the road about how we distribute cultural material. And in that confusion, there have been a lot of understandable pushback from the content industries who are trying to maintain their hold on what they used to hold. But I feel they've often overreached in doing so. And so it was worth trying to explain why it matters not only that we own some cultural creations, but that some of them not be owned, but be shared in common.
Was there a space that you thought wasn't being spoken to? I mean, there's in the last couple of years specifically, there have been some fantastic scholarly books like The Public Domain by Jamie Boyle in particular, Larry Lessig's writings before he kind of moved on to other concerns. Was there something that you felt was going unaddressed that motivated you to take the particular angle that you did on the cultural commons?
Yes, though I should say, first of all, that the two people you've mentioned do wonderful work, and the books you mentioned came out really as I was working on this. So, and as they did, it made it clear that there were certain things I didn't need to do because others were doing it so well. But in a way, another impetus for my project was the moment in the middle 1990s when Congress extended the term of copyright for 20 extra years so that my royalties, my copyrights now run my lifetime plus 70 years, whereas they used to run my lifetime plus 50 years. And what bothered me about this was that it was really a taking from the public domain. That is to say, when copyrights end, things fall into the public domain or the cultural commons, and I think that's a good thing. And what you saw when this law was being proposed was how difficult it was to get anybody to think about why the public domain might matter. And then I began to wonder if there wasn't any historical reasons for that, if looking at American history might not help us think about these matters of ownership and non-ownership. And that's the one piece that I have tried to do that I don't think others have been doing particularly, is to go back to the founding generation and try to excavate from their writings how they thought about what we now call intellectual property.
Speaking of that historical perspective, I very much enjoyed the dimensions you're writing about Benjamin Franklin, added to a founding father whom I actually already admired very much. In addition to Jefferson, who's frequently cited in the modern debates around copyright, you share your thoughts from other contemporaries of those two, Madison and Adams in particular. I'm curious of your thoughts as to how representative Franklin's views of limited monopolies and collaboration are, whether they were common, if not maybe a majority, or more of an exception. My worry is that critics of your arguments around Franklin's examples will be similar to those leveled against the likes of today, Cory Doctorow, Trent Reznor, Amanda Palmer, as exceptions rather than representing any sort of emerging norm.
Well, I think Franklin was representative of the 18th century view and not an exception. The actual exception that I talk about a little bit is Noah Webster, who comes along a little late, but he writes about the Constitution as it's being argued in the 1780s. And Webster was a strong pro-copyright guy and is more representative of what we now think of as the mainstream. But everybody else I talk about really thought that created things, art and ideas, are by nature in the commons, and that we need very good reason to take them out. And they understood that there were some good reasons, particularly to incentivize creative work. But their experience had been that they thought of both patent and copyright as monopoly privileges. And their experience had been that monopolies were typically abused by anybody in power, by the king in England in particular. And so they ought to be granted very cautiously. And so I think Jefferson, Madison, Adams, and Franklin are all on the same page in terms of allowing for a very limited term copyright and patent grant, but being wary otherwise. And you also have to remember that the United States was a pirate nation for 150 years. All through the 19th century, we did not recognize other nations' intellectual property laws because we were happy to import and sell cheaply things made elsewhere. So that was the dominant position, not just in Jefferson and Franklin's time, but all through the 19th century. And that slowly changes as we become much more a net exporter of ideas and art. We become more concerned about having strict rules and getting other people to obey them.
I find, if my memory is correct, if your mention of Webster, wasn't he even kind of maybe not the purest example of a critic? Weren't his views kind of mixed over time?
Well, what's mixed about Webster is that his work, he was famous mostly for the dictionary, but also for spelling books. And if you look closely at how he made those works, they are what we would now call derivative works. He borrowed largely from everybody else. And so large portions of his dictionary came verbatim out of Johnson's dictionary in England. So if Webster were brought forward to the present, he would have trouble publishing the books he published. So it's a mixed case. He wanted strong copyright laws, and he wanted the income from them. And I actually have no argument with that in a properly limited form. But he also was what we would now think of as a plagiarist.
You broaden more than that example that others have advanced of early American history being that of a pirate nation. You go beyond that, in particular in your choice of Franklin, to speak about kind of his views about collaboration. You get into, I think, some wonderful insights as a person, you know, his abnegation of self in doing so. I think I just wanted to mention that because I want the readers to have a more accurate impression of this book, that it's more than just the stories that we've heard before about copyright that others have put out there.
Well, Franklin is a wonderful example. And, you know, he was a genius. Partly my argument is that, he comes down to us as a genius of self-making, that he was a self-made man. And if you look closely at his life, what you see is that his genius was what I think of as the genius of a host, of somebody whose self-making is dependent upon there being a available world around him of ideas. He read voraciously. I'll give you one quick example. You know, he's famous for having invented a wood stove, but he published a pamphlet explaining how it was made. And in the pamphlet, he makes it clear that he figured out how to do it from six books that he read coming out of England and France about wood stoves and how heat and fluids travel. He was a guy who tinkered in the collective shop. He wasn't self-made. He was other-made. and happily so, and recognized it as such. And that's the reason that he first gives for not patenting his own material. He says that he's indebted to the past and he'd be happy to give things to the future. So Franklin never took a patent, never copyrighted his work. And, that stands in opposition to current practice.
Will you go further? It's interesting that you bring up Franklin as that the image of the self-made man. You actually do a pretty good job of debunking that and showing some earlier depiction that don't show him exactly as such versus in particular, a portrait that was imagined and painted after his death. That's the more common visage that you allude to.
Yes, the book reproduces two different portraits of Franklin, one done when he was alive in 1767 or so. And it shows him sitting at a desk reading manuscripts. Off to the right is a bust of Sir Isaac Newton. So it shows him as a sociable person who sits inside of a republic of letters. And then I show a painting done in about 1816, which shows him basically alone in nature, though he's surrounded by helpful cherubs. Discovering how lightning works. And that's a sort of Emersonian vision of Franklin, that in Emerson's ideology, the genius is somebody who goes by himself into nature and has ideas that come more directly from the spiritual world and less from the community around him.
Again, to focus on the example of Franklin, because you discuss him from a variety of angles, and one that I picked up on that I found fascinating is kind of maybe an implication or a subtext of the question of how to live a life balance between the private and the public. I'm thinking in particular of your idea of balancing in some of your supplemental arguments, the copyright with a copy duty, and also the wonderful explanation of trading the immediate benefit to the creator for the eventual benefit to society, at least as the copyright bargain, as you've hinted at, was originally conceived. Chapter 7 and 8 in particular, the common self, and the common self now really, really spoke to me. Is that something that arose as you were working on this and working through some of the history, or was that very intentional coming in, maybe drawing on some of the themes in Trickster and The Gift?
Well, it's hard to know, actually, because some of this I knew before I started the book, and then you discover things as you go along. The idea that, for example, giving somebody a patent is a trade-off between giving somebody a private monopoly for a short term in exchange for the public revelation of the good is something I've known for a long time. And You know, it comes up partly because one thing that's happening in the 18th century is the erosion of guild secrecy. So it used to be that craft guilds had knowledge that they kept secret in order to maintain their leverage as a guild. And it began to arise in the 18th century, and Franklin is an example of this, an ethic of releasing knowledge to the public. So instead of guild knowledge, you have public knowledge. And patent law, when it first emerges, is part of the mechanism by which otherwise secret knowledge gets to be made public. So what you have to do to get a patent is to write such a clear description of your invention that any practitioner could reproduce it. And then you get the monopoly for 20 years or so. But it means that after that, even if you disappear, die, or the invention is forgotten, somebody can look it up and know how to do it. And this is what Franklin does. The example I give is his invention of the lightning rod. He figures out how to make lightning go to ground through a lightning rod. And then he immediately publishes a clear description of how to make a lightning rod in the newspaper and in Poor Richard's Almanac. And he doesn't sign it. He doesn't claim a patent. He simply does the thing that public knowledge requires, which is to publish.
So that's an interesting contrast, as you say, to that secrecy of the guild system. And at least in the time of Franklin and his contemporaries, it appears to have worked a bit better. I think that we could easily put out an observation that time has passed, and maybe that's part of what this book is speaking against. What I'm curious about, and you kind of mentioned but don't go into, is are there some drawbacks on following the parallels of traditional land-based commons a little too closely as an alternative, or not even necessarily an alternative, but something to have alongside of these traditional systems to maybe re-enliven those cultural commons? You talk about the benefits of moving towards the fee simple and private holding, but the risks prior to that of essentially the feudal system of being bound too closely to the land. Are there risks then in encouraging commons as a model worth reviving for the creation of culture? For instance, does something like a neo-patronage model or publicly supported art run the risk of limiting the avenues an artist might feel able to pursue as an alternative to that trade-off that you discussed?
Yeah, so this is a complicated question and well worth trying to think about. One way the book is set up, as you're implying, is beginning with the model of agricultural land-based commons where medieval villages would own the woods and streams and fields nearby and treat them in common. And then many people now are interested in the commons as a metaphorical or model for other kinds of property relations. And there is a puzzle about how much of the old system can really be used in the modern context. And you hint at some of the obvious problems that the medieval commons were part of an aristocratic system with rigid hierarchies and people constrained in how they could move around. And none of us would be particularly pleased to be dropped down into that world again. So the question going forward is what can what pieces of the old commons or what kind of common regimes could we now have that fit into a market democracy such as we have? And so there are many answers to that. I mean, I should say, somebody like Eleanor Ostrom, who won the Nobel Prize 2 years ago for economics, her work is entirely about trying to think about the many different kinds of common ownership that can be discovered around the world. It isn't only agricultural medieval worlds that have these forms. We find them in the present. And then trying to fit them to other factors of present life, such as American individualism. And I'm conscious of that throughout the book, and I guess trying to find the seam where cultural commons can exist and be lively, and at the same time honor some of the other ideological impulses that we have in the current moment.
I'm familiar with Ostrom's work, and I've written about it on my blog, and I'm pleased to hear you mention that as a resource for further reading. I again, to be fair to the listener, I think that you do present a very nuanced and intelligent discussion, and not necessarily, I think as many academic books really do best, not necessarily to provide a concrete answer, So forgive me if I push you a little bit further than the material in the book, but you do give us, I think, an excellent framework to help think about this. And in particular, you do it in a way that I find to be very accessible. It's really a great pleasure to read all of your books. They all exhibit a certain exuberance, not always in evidence when dealing with such weighty topics. Do you think that's a consequence of that you're coming in more as an artist, as a poet? Do you think being an artist affects the substance of your arguments and thought around this, especially compared to similar work from those that I've already mentioned, some of your peers at the Berkman Center?
I guess so. I mean, you know, I come to my books as a creative writer first, and then somebody who's interested in the topic second. Whereas some of my colleagues, you know, people you've mentioned, Jamie Boyle or Lawrence Lessig, they begin as lawyers and then approach these topics. So we have different styles. I find both of them actually write nicely. I like their books, but it's a case that I, you know, I'm interested always in the metaphor and the image and the way the language works and telling stories and figuring out how the stories work and where their edges are. So in a certain sense, I suppose there is a writerly sensibility in my work that's something I am always conscious of. Let me say one other thing. I mean, we're looping around, but I sure. wanted to, this question about the commons in the present moment. One thing I ended up thinking about the 18th century was that they had what I now think of as a civic republican ideal. And in this ideal, private property is valuable. One wants to have individuals and families who own things and own them privately. But they asked the question then, so now that you have that, if you do have a secure base of income and property, to what end do you have it? And for the 18th century, the end was, and this is clear in Franklin, the end is, well, you should turn toward public service of some kind. You should be an actor in your community, or you should be a philosopher or a law person. You know, should do something social, not private. So there's a kind of two-step in which, first of all, you have individual autonomy, and then secondly, you have something for the public. And I still like that. I think it is well worth remembering and reviving in certain contexts because it honors individualism, but it also doesn't limit itself to individualism.
I enjoyed that argument too. And one of the questions that arises, though, in contemplating that is whether there are greater challenges now to fulfilling those obligations of civic republicanism, as you say, with the progress away from, we can't ignore the fact that these were landed gentlemen at that time, and the rise of the American middle class. I mean, what other problems Jefferson and his peers may have encountered or invited as landowners? There seemed to be a much clearer call to devote and the resources to devote to those kinds of efforts towards the public good.
Yeah, this is true. But, you know, it's complicated because, first of all, not all of them were. I mean, Franklin began as a poor kid from Boston whose father was a chandler and who ran away from home. Now, by the time he was in his 40s, he had made some money. But the model today would be then you keep making money. The model then was now Franklin is well enough set up. He stops making money and he starts serving the public good. Or something like Tom Paine. Tom Paine came to Philadelphia with nothing but a letter of introduction from Franklin. He was not a rich man. Jefferson was broke by the time he died. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the economic base is complicated and has to be looked at on a case basis. I think, you know, the ideal in a sense was to have a middle-class nation in which you don't have extremes between rich and poor, and you have people who are middle-class in the simple sense of being able to be relieved of need. And once you have somebody relieved of need, the question then again arises, so now what are you going to do with your life? And the answer was not, I'm going to continue making money. So, you know, what we have now is a world in which we have a greater and greater extreme between rich and poor, and no sense that the rich have any obligations, at least not in our current public dialogue, any obligations to the greater good.
I think it's worth emphasizing, and I think you do this in the book, to deflect some of the criticism that arises when we do talk about more of these issues of social welfare before that sort of extremism that you identify, is that what Franklin was talking about, what you're talking about, really is, even though we talk about duty and obligation, it's still voluntary. And it's more an ethos. We're not talking about a centrally managed, regulated public obligation. We're talking about just people maturing to the point where they understand that they got to the point that they did. Again, to go back to the two-step that you lay out, because they extracted some private benefit from either the sweat of their brow or building on others. But then, and again, this almost touches back on, I'm only a chapter into the gift, but even in that first chapter and in the formatter, touches in on some of the stuff you talk about there, about the gift only remains animated as long as it's moving. If it's captured, if it becomes capital, then it loses that spirit of a gift. So again, I mean, I understand that it's putting in those terms maybe makes it a little harder to approach, a little more complex, but I think that's worth calling out all the same.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you're right that there is a puzzle always about the voluntary aspect of this. And I think, these people were voluntarist individualists. That said, somebody like Franklin believed in taxes. If a community decides to tax itself, we have to ask if that's, where does the voluntary end and the obligation begin? So Franklin made a distinction between necessary property and superfluous property. He thought, the state had no business fussing with your necessary property, but those of us who have superfluous property, Franklin thought of it as a creature of society, and that society could make demands upon it.
That seems like, from my perspective, a reasonable compromise. You're not talking about, but it's a nuanced position. You're not talking about all of one thing or all another. You're talking about more where to draw those lines between those two forms of obligations.
Yep.
To switch gears a little bit, your thoughts on the undue influence between otherwise non-overlapping spheres later in the book is enlightening. Did you have in mind other spaces from today, like the current debate around network neutrality as well? With the understanding that I may have just pushed you into a bit of a minefield by bringing that up.
Well, I should say for listeners, first of all, I draw on a wonderful book of Michael Walzer's called Spheres of Justice. And Walzer says, look, we live in a complex world where there are many spheres of social life, like the army, the marketplace, the church, the family, the educational system, and that these tend to have different norms. You behave differently in these different situations and in different sets of values and stuff. And that a kind of tyranny arises when one sphere begins to dominate all the others. So, if you have a military dictatorship, it's the military that dominates everything else. It runs the schools, it runs the markets, it runs the church. If you have a theocracy, the church runs everything. So for Walzer, having any one sphere tromp on the values of the other spheres is the beginning of tyranny. And so I think it's a useful distinction, partly because I'm not unsympathetic to the problem that the entertainment industry has with file sharing and so forth. I think it's a true problem. That said, I also think it's a problem in the entertainment world, and I'm resistant to the entertainment industry trying to tell the colleges, the educational system, how they should run their business, that those are two different. The norms of sharing knowledge in a college are different from the norms of sharing entertainment in the business world. So that's the kind of distinction I'm interested in. Net neutrality, I don't talk about much in the book and probably don't know enough up to speed to say something wise here, except that I am interested in the category of what are called common carriers. These, in a sense, are the communication systems which groups such as the U.S. nation need in order to talk with one another. And the old idea was that common carriers ought to be open to everybody, that you can't just give rich people the phone number, the phone lines, and the poor people don't get them. Once you set up phone lines, everybody should be on them. And this is part of how you have open conversations. So that's the piece behind the net neutrality discussion that interests me.
Yeah, I couldn't help but thinking about network neutrality when reading through your discussion of the carrier commons. And again, you know, the speaking hall, one of these examples of kind of opening a space intentionally between those spheres that's not, as you say, dominated by any one of them. In that same vein, you seem to be incredibly apt at putting your finger on certain tensions, certain dynamic tensions. In particular, you expand on this conception of value, say market or commodity value versus dignity. Do you think that also has a broader application? That was another instance where I found myself thinking of something that we're really engaged with today as a network society, that of online privacy.
Now, this language comes out of a remark of Immanuel Kant's, who says some things have prices and things that don't have prices have dignities. And in a sense, it's like the old sense that some things are not for sale. Some things are not supposed to be put in the marketplace. A simple example would be if you want to have a lively democracy, you don't put votes up for sale. People have the vote and they can't buy it and sell it. So you're a dignified citizen of a democracy if you don't sell your vote. I'm wondering, in particular, what are you thinking about in regard to privacy?
Well, I'm just thinking about a lot of the problems we seem to get into are just not admitting into that that the spirit of Kant's remark that the big actors in the space, like Facebook in particular, who's constantly in the tech news for trotting on people's privacy, seem to take a price-oriented only view, and they don't admit room for dignity. And we seem to maybe lack language in some of the discussions around this to push back. So it really wasn't necessarily that the book spoke to that. It just kind of sparked a thought that this is something that could be expanded. This is a, you know, fuel for further thought in these sort of spaces that are so market dominated that, you know, the commons doesn't have to be just cultural commons, that there might be other sort of intellectual commons out there where some of the framework, as I say, some of the scaffolding you lay out may be useful to us.
Yeah. So, I mean, to take Facebook as a simple example, you know, a lot of online enterprises are in the end market driven, that the way they're going to make the cash flow is through advertising and selling things to consumers, which means that they have to conceive of their audience primarily in terms of consumers. And so their interest in me and my data is to think about what I might be wanting to buy. And it means that there's a narrow description of what a human being is that almost structurally is built into certain of these interfaces. And to the degree that it reduces human beings to a small portion of what we are, it's a challenge to our dignity.
In the conclusion of the book, this is my last question to wrap stuff up, you praise the Creative Commons as a means to preserve and rebuild, or one means to preserve and rebuild cultural commons. However, I think it could be argued, and I hope you agree, that expression isn't fungible. This is actually something that comes up. I don't know if you've read Neil Nettenall's Copyrights Paradox, where he talks about the free expression conflict with copyright. And some of the market arguments are it is fungible. And my question and my concern is that in advancing just the Creative Commons, as noble as an effort as it is, I'm a sustaining donor. I use it to license my own works. I very much believe in it. I wonder if we're limiting ourselves. We're not accessing some speech that otherwise should be part of the commons, you know, to circle all the way back to our first mentions of the public domain. In the spirit of trickster, if you will, do you have any thoughts, even if they're very speculative? I know this is maybe outside of the pale of the book, going beyond just reinvigorating the commons, to borrow one of the examples that I found, again, really resonant in the earliest passages of the book, to maybe more directly beat the bounds, like what Professor Littman at the University of Michigan or Pamela Samuelson and her ongoing work at Berkeley talk about recently with some of their focus on ideas around legislative reform?
Well, the one thing that I've been mostly involved with that's not particularly mentioned in the book is claiming a fair use and making it a more vigorous part of our copyright regime. So fair use is a piece of the statute. It allows us to use things without asking permission or paying fees under certain circumstances. And people tend not to understand what they're able to do under fair use. And so I've been involved with people at American University, particularly, in trying to help certain practice communities. The best example has been the documentary filmmakers. But we've just done a project with American poets to sit down and talk with practice communities about what problems they run up against in trying to use material that fair use would probably let them use, but they feel inhibited because they either feel threatened by litigation or they don't understand the rules. So we try to surface what the problems are and then get people to sit down and think about how to solve them, what would be fair and just in one situation after another. I'll give you a simple example. A friend of mine published a book of critical essays about poets, and the permission fees for this book were $20,000. Now, it's not a book that'll ever make, you know, probably more than $2,000. It's quite nuts. In fact, she almost certainly has a fair use right to quote without paying fees from the many poets she writes about. And so what we've been trying to do is to help poets and writers in that situation know what the rules of the road are and make clear statements of it. The best place to look at this is actually online at the Center for Social Media at American University. They have a sample of the best practices in fair use for documentary filmmakers and other such groups, and soon we'll have one for American poets.
That's excellent. I'll find a link to that and include that in the show notes. I'm always looking for resources like that to recommend, because I do a bit of public speaking as well and have people ask me for those kinds of things. So, what's next for you? Do you have ideas for another book or another project that you want to talk about?
No, I have glimmers, but I'm not committed yet. The one thing I can say is that the thing I've just done in New York City at Japan Society, there is an exhibition of a medieval Chinese parable about Buddhism called the Ox Herding Series. And a friend of mine who's an artist has worked with me to do a modern version of ox herding. And I have done translations of the old poems from Chinese into English, and he's done new drawings. So at Japan Society in New York, there is currently, and until the middle of January, an exhibition of my work and Max Gimblet, that's the painter, Max Gimblet's work on ox herding.
Excellent. I'm a big fan of Eastern philosophy and early Chinese culture. Studied some in college, so I'll try to find links to those as well for anybody who's in the area or who will be in the area to check those out. Sounds fantastic. Before I let you go, where can people find more information about you and your work?
Well, I have a website which needs to be updated, but it's lewishyde.com. And then on the internet.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. I very much enjoyed all of your books and the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, Thomas. Bye-bye.
That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. The next show, which should be a news program as usual, will go in the feed Sunday night. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.